Hi, I'm Joe Richmond from Radio Diaries, and I'm very happy to be here with these wonderful folks here that I will officially introduce in just a moment. But first, I wanted to ask a question of all of you, take a little survey. You can indicate your response with applause. Number one, how many of you work for a station network organization? All right. How many of you are independent, work on your own? How many of you didn't respond because you kind of fit in the middle or you don't like to clap or something like that? Okay. All right, we have a lot of people who don't like to clap. The point is, and this is the point of what we're talking about this morning, is that once upon a time, most people in public radio and in journalism, in fact, would have been in category number one. Now more and more are in category number two. This is not a surprising point, of course. We know this. But the thing about that is that when you're part of an organization, one of the things you have is guidelines, kind of code of conduct, rules, ethics. You know, maybe they're followed, maybe they're not, but at least they are written down like this. This is the NPR Ethics Handbook, 74 pages. You can download it. It's free on the web. You can download it tonight for bedtime reading on your phone. But what's interesting is that this is actually a really good read. And it's a good read because it's not really about, it doesn't read like rules. It reads like values. So, as Johanna said, it's official this morning, we are in a golden age of radio. We can all say that now. And one of the things that means, you know, I mean, we're in a time when journalism and storytelling are coming together in new ways, and what the result is that some of the most exciting, experimental, creative work is happening in public radio, in podcasts. And it's an amazing thing. And what's coming along with that is it's a time for invention. There's new styles. There are new distribution plans, new ways of doing business. And part of that is they're also being on your own. There are new ways to think about values and how you do what you do and what matters. So that's part of what we're talking about. It's most of what we're talking about today. And the idea isn't to maybe come up with answers so much as it is to say this, it's important to talk about, and these are important questions, and it's important to have the conversation. And to have that conversation, I'd like to introduce our panel today. Brooke Gladstone is the host and managing editor of On the Media, and also the author of The Influencing Machine, a media manifesto. And when Johanna and I talked to Brooke about being part of a panel that would talk about kind of the ethics of journalism and storytelling, Brooke said, "I would rather stick ice picks in my eyes." So. Andrea Salenzi is the producer of the daily news podcast, The Gist, with Mike Pesca, and the host of her own weekly radio show and podcast called YOY. I just need to underline something there. I just said daily news podcast and weekly radio show.
At the same time.
That's carpal tunnel.
That's crazy. So when I asked Andrea what she thought about a panel about ethics, she said, "This is a panel I would usually walk out of halfway through at the point when the discussion becomes, my recorder stopped working and I lost my sheep sounds, so I found some other sheep sounds. Can I use those sheep sounds?" And people get all upset, and there's a huge discussion about which sheep sounds you can use and if it's important to use the right breed of sheep. This was actually, by the way, a real Third Coast panel. Roman Mars is the creator and host of 99% Invisible, and those sheep sounds... Roman remembers that panel. And he said he didn't walk out. Instead, he remembers egging on the conversation because he thought it was really funny. So as you see, we have engineered the perfect ethics panel. Let's give them a round of applause just for being here. So we have some tape clips to play. I hope you guys would just kind of jump in whenever. I know you will. I don't really have to say that. But I want to start with Brooke because... Yeah, I want to say I find ethics interesting and fun, but and important. And I realize that most people, the word ethics or the idea of ethics is just boring or even annoying. And I think it's because ethics is often defined too narrowly as kind of right and wrong and good and bad. And I will say, if we come out of this conversation with the idea of right and wrong and good and bad, we will have failed you. So that's not where we're going. It's really about bigger ideas. And those ideas change periodically. You know, the fashions, we've gone from sort of objectivity through fairness, and now we're sort of in transparency. So I thought you could talk a little bit about the arc of these trends and also what the hell these words mean anyway.
Right. I hope that you're excited to know that Joe hopes that his goal is that when you leave here, there's absolutely nothing of value that you can take with you except more questions. No, just kidding. I think that I wanted to stick ice picks in my eyes because these discussions, especially in the early part of the work I did, centered around people who sort of imbibed the values of the mid-50s when the whole mid-20th century, which was anomalous in American history, and decided that there was only one right way to do it, as Joe said, regardless of context, intention, or, you know, the weather, all of which can change the kind of decisions you make. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't have rules that you set for yourself, and I think we're going to get to that later. But in terms of style and truth and reality, a lot of that depends on the relationship of the writer to the audience, the understood relationship. The newspapers in the 19th century were full of willful lies, and most of the consumers of news back then would buy lots and lots of newspapers in order to, you know, check one against the other. And there didn't seem to be much outrage when a story was entirely made up. Some of the greatest writers of the era took to writing made-up stories in newspapers. Edgar Allan Poe did a famous one about a balloon going to the moon, and there was a famous Mark Twain story about a man with a petrified leg that was found, and this kind of thing. And there was much said about that, and Twain's response was, why, you know, there's no danger in lying about a man with a petrified leg. What's really wrong is the silence over slavery, you know, which might seem like a big stretch, but he meant that he had a lot of contempt for the medium, I think, even though he spent quite a lot of time in it, and he felt it could just be used. There was nothing wrong in entertaining and diverting people. It didn't do any harm. And I wonder if, you know, that thought ever enters the minds of any of you radio producers. You know, this will bring joy into somebody's life, and it's not going to do any harm. And, you know, back in the day, that was fine. Really, it was fine. Most people didn't believe what they read. Nowadays, every single... And then in the mid-century, you did believe what you read. And I'll just get through this really fast. The mid-century was really weird. It was the first time that media became more expensive rather than less expensive because of television, which was an incredibly expensive medium. It needed huge audiences. So it had to create this big middle, a consensus that people could sign on to. That's why it was so bland, so white, so waspy, so suburban. This was the reality that all Americans had to sign on to, regardless of whether you were an immigrant or couldn't, you know, or broke or lived in the cities or, you know, were of not, or weren't white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. That was just the way it was. We all had to identify with the cleavers no matter what our backgrounds were. And to some extent, we saw the way that we deviated from them as abnormal. So the golden age of consensus was really one of exclusion. And then you have a newsman like Walter Cronkite, who, you know, was voted most trusted man in America, who said, with unbelievable arrogance when you think about it, that's the way it is at the end of every newscast. And, you know, no one would dare say anything like that now. No one would have the temerity. Later, there were similar polls, and especially among the millennials, and John Stewart came out at the top of those polls. And why? Is it just because he's lovable? It's really because rather than the fake objectivity that created a kind of false normal in the middle of the century. We have transparency. And David Weinberger, the internet visionary, said that transparency is the new objectivity. In other words, that's the way we build trust. And so the style of the reporter, the anchor, the storyteller being present, even in news, I mean, leaving aside all the storytelling that the people in this room do as art or as memoir, this is, you know, this is a style that has intruded increasingly into the news, and it's not new. It dates back again to the days of the muckrakers, where the intentions were clear, but the information was still good. So I think the style is shifting back to an earlier time, one in which the role of the person presenting the news is very present. How present depends on the context, and the quality of the information depends on the understanding you have with your audience. That's kind of new, because we've never had so many fragmented audiences with so many different kinds of rules. I mean, if you gave me a list of podcasts that I listen to, I will tell you exactly how much I believe what that particular person is saying in each case. If that relationship isn't clear, then I think you have a problem. I really do, and I guess we'll talk to that. But the fact that we've moved to this era and the fact that we don't like the word ethics makes sense, because ethics, as Joe said, sounds absolutist and one size fits all, whereas codes of behavior, which is where I think we're going to go, is something that you create for yourself, every individual producer.
I was going to go somewhere else, but since you were talking about, you know, putting yourself in it and sort of the different kind of rules of podcasts, I think many people in this room are familiar with On the Media, with 99% Invisible, maybe not so much with Andrea's podcast, and I thought we just should start with a little bit of sample of that. Andrea, do you just want to set up just what your podcast is for a second, and I'll play a clip.
Sure. My show is a weekly podcast on WFMU, so it airs in the New York, New Jersey area. And I do it as a volunteer, so I'm not paid to do it. And WFMU has a long history in our talk show programming of being incredibly creative. So this is the home of the best show on WFMU, where John Worcester was a reoccurring character. Philly Boy Roy, he's sometimes Gene Simmons, he's been Carl Rove. This is also the home of an early version of Theory of Everything called Too Much Information with Benjamin Walker, where he's also kind of constantly playing with the boundaries. So WFMU is not a news station. We're mostly a music station, and incredibly freeform. So I love doing a show there. This is from an early episode, and I'm recapping something that happened in a previous week with a reoccurring guest whose name is Randy.
If you're just joining the show, I met Randy a few weeks ago at a bar, and he agreed to give me a review for the program. How did I look? How was my wit? What did he think of me as a potential date?
I give you a B. I give you a B. Solid B. I thought you were fine. I thought you were overeager. I thought you couldn't handle your out. Were you drinking?
I just had like one drink.
You were really, really lippy. I mean, you were talking and talking, yip, 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 yapping, and it sort of put me off, to be honest. I don't really like anyone who's too forward.
And he said some things that people are still emailing me about.
Beyond that, you were very attractive for someone of your size. I thought you were...
Someone of my size?
It's kind of stumpy. You know, I'm 6'2". How tall are you?
Yeah, I'm 5'2".
Yeah. But, I mean, you held it well. You know, some short people look dumpy, but I thought you looked pretty good.
And there was this.
You had a very clean, rural smell to you. That's a compliment. That's not a put down. It was like being outside on a beautiful spring day in Maryland.
This week, he told me something new. He told me he finally listened to the show.
A friend of mine burned it on CD, and I was listening on my portable CD player when I was doing exercises in my condo gym.
And he's disappointed in me.
And I have to say, truthfully, you edited out a lot of things.
Well, that's my job. We talk for an hour, and I need to make it a 20-minute segment.
Yeah, but so. You edited out things that should have been left in, not only from my standpoint, but from your standpoint. Like, I remember you talking about problems with your dad and your last boyfriend and the boyfriend before that. And that
no one needs to hear that stuff. I mean, it's about getting to know you.
Yeah, but you were saying things like, you know, you once slept with the backup guitarist for a... Things like that I find interesting, so I don't know why you would then... You tell me, you would then it wouldn't go over the air.
I love that last moment where he's calling me out, like, as a documentarian, because... I feel like that's something we always worry about sometimes when you've been interviewing someone for a while and maybe you started to kind of get in with them about something that they were talking about where you're like, oh, yeah, I feel the same way, but that never makes it into the interview.
I mean, your show is not just transparency. It's like extra, extra, extra transparency. Do you have kind of a, you know, philosophy code that sort of, you know, is the foundation of that?
Well, okay, so after we had Randy on the show for the first time, I kind of became overwhelmed with emails asking me, is this guy real? Like, did you actually find the worst human being in New York City? Because, like, over as we get to know Randy, we learn that he's misogynist, he's sexist, he's racist, he has a horrible taste in music, he loves Rocky the Musical, like, just Barnum is his other favorite musical. He's just, like, a horrible person. But we have a friendship. But the thing I really think of with the Randy segments is, like, he's compelling, and I love to listen to him talk, but it's also about me. It's about the ways I feel vulnerable when I'm dating. It's about how... I like when he's mean to me. I like when he insults me. I like when he calls me out on stuff. So it's I'm using my conversations with him to tell a larger story about me.
But you didn't answer the question.
Oh, what was the question?
Is he real?
Oh, I think if I answer that question, I don't ever want to answer that question. I think it sucks the energy out of what I've been creating. So I don't want to answer it. But if he weren't real, I think
How much can you probe, Brooke?
Yeah. If he wasn't...
I don't want to put my fellow panelists on the spot.
Oh, go for it.
Because,
I love that.
I think you're wonderful.
Uh-huh.
I really do. But if... I don't think there's anything the slightest bit stumpy about you.
It's not okay, right?
But I think that, you know, it's even possible to have a relationship or an understanding with your audience where it's actually... intended to be ambiguous. But I think you're right that if he weren't real, then that might suck some of the energy out of the situation. And so in that case, if the energy is dependent on the authenticity of this guy's outrageousness, then I would see that as potentially a violation of that understanding with the audience.
Yeah. Well, something I was thinking about was that I think people do know to ask that question, is this real? No one came to what I was creating with the assumption that it was real, the way you would if it were on This American Life.
How do you know that? Or does it matter? You believe it.
I
mean,
you don't know what everybody Well, you were talking about that time where we would all look at the newspaper and be like, that one's a faker, this one's for real. Yeah. And I think that that's what we do with the internet. We say, oh, where'd you learn that? On Wikipedia? Or there's these great websites of people believing The Onion. So we're starting this conversation of, like, how does this happen? And we look at a viral YouTube video and we say, oh, is that Jimmy Kimmel? So we're bringing this, like, lens to all photography now. Was that photoshopped? You know, how was that changed? So I got to hang out with my mom yesterday, and she said, I saw this thing on Facebook that all Beanie Babies are full of spider eggs. That's not real, right? But, like, the question was there. She didn't say, I saw this thing about the Beanie Babies. Like, she learned to ask that question, is it real? So she got to go through the wonderful, like, I think it's a fun process where you imagine that it's real, and you're like, what if my basement is full of spider eggs hatching out of Beanie Babies? So you get to have that moment, but then you kind of go, oh, but that's probably not real, right?
Um, I think that's a great part A of this conversation, and I think part B we're going to revisit in a little bit because we have some other things that I think will support it. But and just for this purpose, I just want to interrupt for a second to say I asked a bunch of people for their golden rules, basically, you know, their version of the radio version of the golden rule, and we collected some. And maybe Roman, do you want to just like take one out? You could like read.
Sure.
And then we're going to move on to something else.
This is from Linda Lutton,
who is a reporter here at Chicago WBEZ.
Right. I constantly remind to myself of who my boss is and why I have a microphone. I say it to myself just about every day. I work for the public, so I ask myself, does the public need to know about this and why?
Yeah, sure. Everyone do one. We have plenty. This is for those moments when the conversation goes a little bit off the rails.
This from Nick Vanderkolk.
This should be good.
Except for maybe total sociopaths, everyone has a moral code, no matter how dubious their morals might appear to the outside world.
This is from Dave Isay. Don't be an asshole. Be straight up with your subjects. Do what you're saying you're going to do.
You know, there's one thing about... Dave also talks, some of these are edited, but Dave also talks something so specific and simple. If you say you're going to give them a story, give them a copy of the story, make sure to give them a copy of the story. I think that's, I love that one. So the thing about golden rules, of course, is, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It's not enough to just do unto others. You have to know, like, how you want to be done unto. You know, you have to know sort of what you think to start that conversation. So that's part of what we're talking about. I want to turn to you, Roman, to talk a little bit about almost the design of radio. We've talked about how, you know, radio has this advantage in that people think there's this authenticity, there's this, like, realness. It's all so true. And, of course, a lot of times in terms of media literacy, what you were referring to, people have no idea what's really happening underneath.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you're trying to do is, the real world is the real world and it's authentic. And then when you introduce microphones into that world, it becomes inauthentic. And what the craft is working your way back into making it real again or feel real again. And so I think that actually takes a lot of work. We have the opportunity as producers or presenters or reporters to be our best selves. I mean, we get to write ahead of time. We get to think about it for weeks at a time and say the right thing. And the person you're interviewing doesn't have that luxury. So I like to give them, unless it's some situation where, like, I've interviewed politicians and I don't try to make them sound any better, but I like to give other people the opportunity to sort of represent their best selves, their clearest thought, and that, you know, often means, you know, rearranging what they say, as long as it reflects their intention.
That gets us really nicely to this next cut. I think you know which one I'm going to be leading to. This is kind of a classic. This has become a classic piece of tape from NPR reporter John Nielsen that came by way of Planet Money's David Kestabop. A lot of people have used this. I just learned that you use this too.
Totally.
Do you want to set it up?
It was like for West Nile virus or something.
Avian flu in the zoos. People worried about.
Yeah, worried about it. And so like he's interviewing a zoo, the zookeeper, about whether or not everyone who lives around a zoo should be worried about avian flu.
Zoos are part of the community in which they exist, and that community either has risk or does not have risk, and there's no difference within the zoo boundaries than with outside the zoo boundaries. So we actually are...
Risk. Oh, you didn't say that right. The community, just do that again, that was great though. I mean, no, here, look, I told you this already, but I'm at the end of the bar, I'm really drunk. I want you to make this point. I want you to hold my interest. But, you know, I am a real dumb shit, and I'm going to fall over and get a hematoma if you don't give this to me. So, and I'm convinced that I'm going to die if I go to the zoo. Okay? If I go to the zoo, I'm going to die, buddy. I don't care who you are. You know, so you tell me, you got 10 seconds to tell me why I don't have to worry about the zoos.
Zoos are not any different than the surrounding area in which they exist. There's no reason to believe that coming inside a zoo wall presents a greater risk than being outside the zoo walls. They're part of the community in which they exist. The animals here are just as susceptible as the people, and it's a citywide or a region-wide thing, not a specific hotspot.
How do you know that?
We know that because we test our animals a lot. We test for mosquitoes. We look for mosquitoes. We actually do more surveillance inside the zoo than the cities do or the counties do outside the zoo. So we actually know our risk much more than say, another part of the city.
And it's low.
And it's very low, yeah. Thanks.
I love that clip.
I just want to say that's proof positive that Mormons are not shy.
After
I don't know why I said that.
After Kestenbaum presented that at a Third Coast, we actually had him on Resound, and Gwen interviewed John Nielsen about it.
He's very proud of it, which I love.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little. Since we played it on the radio, I mean, it made him a little nervous because it's kind of an insider piece of tape. But I loved his explanation for it, which pretty much is what I said before. It's like you're causing, it's the reporter uncertainty principle. You're causing him to not be himself. And so that coaching is about him getting back to himself. And particularly because our medium is linear and time-based, you can't go back and read the thing again if you didn't understand it in the newspaper. You have to get it the first time, or his quote was, or you get distracted and all of a sudden 10 minutes later Sylvia Pajoli's on and you're just out the airlock and you have no idea where that story went. So you have to keep people's attention the whole time.
It's called you've been Pajoli'd.
And I think that's totally true. And when I play that for people, you know, it hits some people as really scandalous. It's hits some people as really, you know, great and just intriguing. I think I'm in the camp of intriguing. As a producer, you know, my job is to make things that, you know, sound good and be true, but I need them to sound good too and work, do the job.
The other thing that happens in that tape, of course, is not just how he's pushing, but also then how he comes back to ask the question that's in the tape. And that's that's the nicest moment. And it's a reminder. You know, I mean, you know, Brooke, those sort of rules have changed, say, at a place like NPR. I think there was a time when you would never put yourself in the tape as a reporter, and that has changed a lot.
When I went to Moscow, I did it a lot, and I never got any pushback except that I heard that one of the All Things Considered hosts objected to it. But that was the only...
Which one?
You don't have to answer that.
It rhymes with Schmertheimer. Anyway, you know, I think that it's just reporters didn't do it. I think it was something that was more in kind of in the air, that reporters would be more absent. But I didn't get that much pushback from it. I mean, I think if I'd done it in... you know, a 3.5-minute story from D.C., I might have gotten more pushback, but I was doing a lot of these longer features from Russia, and I think they just cut me slack.
I thought we'd talk for a second just about some of, like, the... I find interesting the kind of very specific examples of what makes people queasy or not. I mean, I think... my favorite is that I think we all accept... I mean, first of all, I'd say that there's a lot of stuff that goes on sort of the basic NPR two-way host interview that listeners would actually be pretty kind of feel kind of fooled by. So the stuff, you know, it happens all the time in what we do. But for example, we all accept that we can take pauses out. I think some people feel like it's a little bit weirder to put pauses in for dramatic effect.
I think that's weird. Actually, I rearrange people wildly all the time for clarity and more concision, but a pause suggests an emotional thinking moment, And to me, that would be like putting, you know, some sort of weird piano chord between one clause and another. To me, that would not be clarifying, sharpening, maybe even shortening the reality, but actually contributing to it. So I take pauses out all the time, and I leave pauses in when I think that they have content, you know, and I think that they actually contribute content. But to put one in would almost be like putting a word in the mouth of that person, and I think that would cross over my line.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. That doesn't cross over my line at all. I think I would put in, if there was a natural big pause, I would leave the pause, mm-hmm. but I would maybe tweak it to match the beat of the music that I'm using underneath.
Yeah, no, that's fine if there were a natural big pause, but if there weren't one, yeah. I wouldn't take one and stick it in there. If I had if you're scoring to music, that's an entirely different process anyway.
I once edited a 2-minute story and was asked to add a pause during sobbing, and it changed the way I hear the whole show now, because it was like, because I realized how they were using that as a tool to evoke emotion in their program.
Wow.
I actually asked everyone on this panel to bring in something that made them really queasy. It didn't work because nothing makes you guys queasy.
No.
I learned. So I brought in something which I don't feel that queasy about, but I know, but I think it makes other people queasy. This is just a story that we did about Asa Carter and Forrest Carter. Forrest Carter, who wrote The Education of Little Tree, this wonderful book, but he had a background as Asa Carter, this staunch segregationist racist, and they were the same person. Let me just play this for a second.
Forrest Carter died in Texas in 1979. He was brought back to Alabama, and they buried him out in the country where he grew up. The tombstone reads, Asa Earl Carter.
Okay, I want you to hear this one part of it again, where he says when he died.
Forrest Carter died in Texas in 1979.
Okay, so this is what he actually said.
In 1970.
Okay, I mean, this is a bit of a function of the way we work without script, but he said the wrong date, 1970. So my co-producer at the time, Samar Freemark, found an N from the 19, and she also used this word to make him say the right date.
Turpentine.
Wow.
So I played this for students at Columbia University, and they looked at me with this like face of like shame and sadness.
I think I don't have any problem with that.
I don't have any problem with that.
Wow.
But I think what I find interesting about it is the point of making someone lie to tell the truth.
Is he lying? Wait a minute. Just correcting an error, right? I mean, did he believe it was, you know, the other date, or did he just misspeak?
I think he just misspoke.
But, so you could have gotten him back, but you didn't. You just reconstructed it. But you didn't change his intention. You didn't change the point of it. You corrected a very minor fact.
Okay, I'm not trying to absolve myself, but I think the point is, like, if there's a difference between the letter and the spirit of something like this. The letter of certain codes and ethics and what, you know, you can get around those pretty easily. What is the spirit of it?
I guess for me, and, you know, I haven't thought about it in these terms before, but if this comes up as a point of, I'd be more concerned about, you know, getting the fake sheep sound than I would about, which I'm not concerned about, then I would this, correcting a minor mistake of fact. I mean, for me, adding or subtracting something real that inflects what the listener is hearing, which is why the pause matters to me so much more than correcting this number, is the point. I mean, it gets back to that, the person's golden rule about, you know, what do you think they need to know? I mean, it's like a fake allegiance to the truth. You know, if you were a producer who said, he should be more upset there, so I'm going to put a big long pause in so it sounds like he's thinking, but it would be wrong to correct the, you know, the zero and make it a nine. To me, that's just 100% wrong on both counts.
Let's go to those sheep sounds. I want to ask Andrea and Roman, both of you, what is your thing about sheep?
About sheep sounds.
But let's talk about fact-based sounds.
I think you can set the scene with whatever. I don't have a real strong sense of that. I think you can set. You can use fake sheep.
Actually, you know what? A better way to get into this is I should play that the tape.
Okay.
Sorry, were you going to say anything?
No, I think I'd love to hear that tape.
Okay, because part of the idea for this panel, the sports.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Part of the idea for this panel came from Roman played this tape last year at the Filmless Festival, and it prompted this idea of we think about ethics in lots of different ways, whether it's political bias or funding or kind of the journalistic craft stuff. But we don't think about the sound so much.
Yeah. This is a piece that I didn't. I presented it. It was done by Pez Andrews for Falling Tree Productions. It's one of my favorite documentaries. It's called The Sound of Sport, and it has a section in it about fake sound in sports broadcasts.
There's some sports that you just cannot capture the natural sound. Cross country skiing, biathlon is another one. Because of the size of the course. And this has been further complicated because as the camera lenses have gone up 110, 120, 130, 140 to 1, these cameras are able to see a half a kilometer, maybe even a kilometer down the course. Now, how do you replicate that sound? Essentially, if you got cameras that are that far apart from each other, you're putting 20 or 30 microphones to fill as the athletes are coming to you, which is not practical. I am not a purist whatsoever in sound production. I truly believe that whatever the tool takes to deliver a high-quality, entertaining soundscape, it's all fair game.
Redgrave and Pinson still hold the lead. The French in third, and we could do without seeing them at the moment.
In Atlanta, one of my biggest problems was rowing. Rowing is a 2-kilometer course. They have 4 chase boats following the rowers, and they have a helicopter. Okay, that's what they need to deliver the visual coverage of it. Okay, but the helicopter and the chase boats just completely wash out the sound. So no matter how good the microphones are, you cannot capture, you cannot reach and isolate sound like you do visually. But people have expectations. Okay, if you see the rowers, they have a sound that they're expecting. So what do we do? That afternoon, we went out on a canoe with a couple of rowers and recorded stereo samples of the different type of effects that would be somewhat typical of an event. And then we loaded those recordings into a sampler and played them back to cover the shots of the boats.
And the Australians have bitten something back from them, but not enough. Great Britain, gold medals! Stephen Redgrave, Matthew Pinson, mission accomplished.
Stand by. And the racing. Good evening, dispatch. Although
when we do our horse racing, you're not going to get somebody running around the course after the horses. There's no way. And occasionally you will come across very close-up pictures of the horses over the far side, which is done off one of our roving cameras. But you have engine noise in that case, so therefore you wouldn't want a microphone on that, because all you would hear is the car revving up and the cameraman cursing. So basically, the way you cover all that sort of stuff is to run a tape which has the sound of horses' hooves galloping, which is actually, if I remember rightly, a slowed-down buffalo charge. That's pretty much a standard thing, and I think it's probably the same recording they've used for years.
I love it. It's not even a horse.
The right breed of buffalo.
Yeah, it makes me so happy. I think that's great. When I put it out, I think particularly because of sports in particular is kind of a sort of meritocratic sort of, you know, like winners and losers and things are factual and stuff like that. I think people are particularly, alarmed by any aspect of it being you know, faked or juiced up or whatever. That was we got a strong reaction to that. I don't personally think there's anything wrong with any of that stuff for that.
I'm against it.
We're not, remember, we're not just doing this right-wrong thing.
Well, you know, I mean, if this were in a documentary, I'd be all for it. If this were even a special produced 10 minutes after the event, I'd be all for it. But if this is being presented as happening on the spot, in other words, if this is being presented as news, live news, then that is... Or if you said some of the sound has been altered to, you know, to make this more enjoyable or whatever word you came up with, then I'd be fine with that as well. But it's the context. It's always about the context. If this is supposed to be a real event, then it needs to be real.
So I asked my colleague Mike Pesca about his golden rule, and his golden rule is be interesting. And I love it. I think it's so simple, and it applies to everything. But I feel like that sports experience was made more interesting. So it's serving the story, and it's serving the goal of the work, and keeping your guests factually accurate, taking out their ums. Like, this all makes it more interesting. So I'm comfortable with things that serve the story and don't mislead in a news context. So, I don't know, the question I was thinking in my head is, like, when do you use a disclaimer? Like, what if every sporting event said, just so you know, here's where the microphones were located, so you know that this is... I think drawing attention to the process can sometimes detract from the interestingness.
I agree. I mean, that reminds me of the tape that the other one about Heyoon. You know, Alex Goldman did this piece for us and that Sam worked on about this sort of place that Alex would go to in high school that he called Heyoon because they misread the sign. It was actually a place, the Hayden Pavilion. And Alex had all these interviews. So he'd been kind of working on this for like 10 years, like getting different tape and interviewing his friends. And it was really great, but Sam Greenspan, one of the producers on the show, was really into the idea of like kind of reenacting the breaking into Heyoon, and so he gathered a bunch of people, I think mainly from Snap Judgment, to come over to my house and record it in the field. And we did think about when do we disclaim that this is fake and not so. We play it.
A path behind the house led to this thin line of trees, but once you made it through the trees, you were in this huge field. And there was something else there in the field. Something man-made. Something really big.
Right up here. Right up here.
Okay.
Hey.
Here's what we gotta do. When we get up to that clearing... Everybody run as fast as you can.
How far?
Until you see it. Okay, ready? 3, 2, 1. Go! There it is.
Whoa.
Welcome to Heyoon.
Oh, it's beautiful.
So I don't remember if we really had the discussion or not, but we didn't say it was a reenactment until the credits. And I'm cool with that.
I'm cool with it, too. First of all, you did say it, just like, you know, a disclaimer at the end of a newscast saying... Some of the sound was added later or recorded earlier. Also, I think you cued it. I think the audience, the listener, would know, partly with the use of the music, that you've moved into an reenactment zone. I loved that piece. It's brilliant.
And something I love about that piece is, like, there was a goal of truthiness in the reenactment, like actual lines were said that they could imagine being said in the moment. You know, the journey into the space was made to mimic the actual journey into the space. So I feel like it was more interesting to do it this way. And it wasn't like, oh, we'll just go to the beach. Like, you guys actually made it sound the way it was supposed to sound.
Yeah, I mean, the things that we had them say were things from the tape when people said, you know, what were the rumors about the place? And then the characters acted them out. So, like, it to me, it was totally real. It just was, it was done in a stylized way. But we wanted, to me, the truth of the piece is the feeling of having a secret place that you went to. And, I mean, I guess... Yeah, but I thought it would be inartful to pre-disclaim it, and that was more important.
The information is there for somebody who wants it. Yeah. Well, not everybody wants it.
Yeah, that goes back to what we were talking about before, Brooke. I assume what you're saying is, as long as listeners understand, as long as it's about the contract of the listeners, as long as it's clear in some way,
I have to say,
Go ahead.
I listen to a lot of radio, and I have to admit, I really like being confused. I don't know. Does anyone like being confused?
There are spaces where being confused is absolutely appropriate. That's part of the relationship. It's, but you don't want to necessarily turn into, the ABC world of sports and be confused.
I get that. But I never want to know about Randy. I don't want to know about Randy. I like that tension.
I'd like to hear one more clip from Randy, though.
Okay.
You were going to say something?
But I agree that my most memorable listening experiences were those moments of confusion and those moments of wondering. I just feel like it's a whole other kind of listening, and it leaves a mark every time that's happened for me.
Let's go back to Randy for one second.
Which Randy?
This is Fight.
Okay, so one piece of information that you should know before you hear it is that Randy works at Quiznos, and one of his, or he used to, he's lost his job. this whole incident. But one of his favorite lines that he wrote for Quiznos is, you might remember it from the stores, is quiz no, quiz yes. do you have funeral?
I have funeral. Let's do that.
I think that's the one I was thinking of. I just can't be everything to you. Like, I can only be so much here. And I have to have, boundaries.
If I were to die, would you give a speech at my funeral?
Of course. Of course. I would be there, and I would give a speech.
What would your first line be?
Gathered here today to remember my friend Randy.
All right. Go on.
He was a guest on my radio program, YOY, which airs every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WFMU.
Are you kidding? You're going to promote your show during my funeral speech?
No, I'm making a joke.
That's all you can say about me? Was that I was on your show?
No, that was a joke. I would say a lot changed for me after I met Randy. That night, he told me I smell like hay. He called me yappy. He gave me a B, solid B. But when I think of Randy, I give him an A. I'd give him an A+. Because A+ as a friend. Because he told it like it is.
That's good, but it's not funny. I got to make it funnier.
Okay, and then I would say, Quizno, quiz eternal. Something about your jokes will live on, long
you're
after you're
up.
Gone.
See,
really?
This is what you do. You cheer me up. No one else can cheer me up like this.
Oh, good.
What else would you say after I commit a suicide?
No, the funeral I'm picturing is not after you commit suicide, because I'm really not. You can't do that to me. So,
I'm too wild to live forever. But I live fast, die young. That's my.
I say live old. Die the way old people die.
That's not very cutting edge.
Okay, but I need you to stay around. You have an obligation to your Twitter followers and to the listeners of the show. And
that is true. And I want to take you to go see Rocky the Musical. So that is something to live for.
I really don't want to do that with you, but we'll do something else that's really fun.
Think about it. Okay, two tickets to Rocky.
So for me, there's that feels like, whether or not Randy's real, there's a truth in that for me. Like, you've had, if anyone's had a friend threaten suicide or commit suicide. You have these moments where you're like, where that is being wielded in a way that can control you and obligate you to them and feel very real. And my relationship with Randy started very lighthearted and this, like, we met at a bar and what did you think of me? And it gets dark. And I've had listeners create evidence dungeons trying to figure out if he's real or not. I've had listeners call me because they found my phone number to convince me not to let Randy's friend Noah come to New York. Like, people get really into it, and I like that feeling. But if I were to say whether or not he's real in an episode, how would that just would feel like a waste of characters. It would just feel like why?
Do another golden rule. We haven't done some golden rules. Can we?
Yeah. This is from Alex Kalowitz. When dealing with regular people, i.e. private individuals as opposed to public, remember that we are at their invitation. Tell your subjects what will be in the story and give them the opportunity to respond.
Marianne McCune, say what you mean. Don't forget that you are a radio professional.
Those are two different ones. The radio professional I wrote in there because she said that last night as I was getting stressed out about this session.
Oh, so this was your edition?
It's my
edition. You should have initialed it.
But I think that's a good one for ethics to remember. Okay.
This is from Ben Shapiro. Know what you want your story to do in the world.
I'll read one. I did learn, thinking about golden rules, I did learn that there is a golden rule insurance company and a golden rule airlines, which is in Kyrgyzstan and is on the list of banned airlines in the European Union. Glenn Washington, never, boring. Also, the sleep test. If you think it's going to keep you up at night wondering if you did the right thing, don't do it. But if you did it, stay up that night and figure out how you're going to make it right.
I like that.
Yeah.
That's good.
Okay. I have one little thing. I brought another thing that I find interesting, just that came up in my work at one point. We were doing this big series on Mandela with tons of archival tape, and this guy is talking about, you know, in the 40s in South Africa, how you had to be, blacks had to leave the city at a certain time, and he's talking about the bells. It's like, oh, it would be so great to have bells under here. And here's what we did.
At 9 o'clock, a big bell would ring, dong, dong, and you knew that was for you, if you were black, to get out of the white city.
So I'm playing that because I got lucky in this situation. I found a record of bells from Johannesburg in the 1940s. So those are actual bells.
That's really lucky.
That's really lucky. From Johannesburg in the 1940s. And I don't get to tell people that a lot, so I'm glad I can share that. But it raises a question. So two things that it brings up for me is, one, like, you know, this stuff is hard, and it should be hard, and you shouldn't cheat, and you shouldn't take shortcuts, and you actually, journalism is just kind of, it's tough, and you should kind of go that extra mile. That's one thing. But it also brings up, okay, if those were bells in the 1950s, if I'd found that record, and maybe it was Durban, would I have used them? Yes. If it was, I don't know, you know.
It's a documentary.
Nigeria, but I don't know. But if those were bells from Poughkeepsie, I would feel weirder. I just think it raises, like, there is no kind of black and white boundary here. And so I was trying to think, well, what is my, I think Poughkeepsie, I might not have used those bells if they were church bells from Poughkeepsie. You understand what I'm saying?
If the bells in Poughkeepsie worked in the documentary, I don't think I would, you know, stress over it.
Really?
No, this is to create, he's recalling bells. He's going bong, bong, bong. If you didn't have some bongs there, you'd be crazy.
And you just sound effects record, just pull off a sound effects record and throw the bells in?
It's a documentary. You want authentic sound if you can find it, or something is close to authentic, of course. But I can't imagine a situation where no old bell from Europe or from Africa could be procured, the sound of which could be can be procured for your purposes.
But then it's just your own kind of sort of amusement, which is actually
I don't think so.
What is the difference between the finding the sound effect versus some African bell that you find on an archival recording?
Because the closer you can get to the experience he's recalling, the better. I mean, if you can get right there, that's the absolute best. But then, to the extent of your ability as a documentarian, you move a few steps away until you've moved too far, and then you can't try and convey the sense of that experience in a documentary.
Okay. Sorry, go on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Poughkeepsie is too far, apparently.
Poughkeepsie's too far.
I guess. That's your limit.
Well, okay, here's an example where I think actually you say documentary, but I mean, this is from a story about the history of Burma and the student massacre that happened there in 1988. And I'm just going to play this and tell you about the sounds under there.
Instead of free elections tonight, it looks as though Burma may be in for a bloodbath. A new hardline president seized power. He ordered a curfew, banned demonstrations, and told the army to fire on protesters.
I remember it was in the afternoon Rangoon time, and suddenly there was the most horrendous, terrifying sound.
We could see from the embassy students cowering behind trees without any weapons, and they were being shot. These students were running from the violence, and the soldiers running after them, shooting them as if it was on a rabbit hunt. It was bone-chilling.
So those gunshots are pretty important for that scene. The gunshots that were used at the time in coverage from BBC and from American networks were not really the gunshots that happened in that moment that they're talking about. And we were going to use them because it felt like, okay, we pulled archival stuff. It feels, you know... But there's something that feels very different about this situation. We're talking about a specific place, a specific moment, and the gunshots felt like they needed to be the real gunshots that happened there.
Where were the gunshots from?
From BBC? Or these?
I mean, where did those gunshots occur? Do you know?
These gunshots that we used, we ended up getting lucky again from Bruce Wallace, who we were worked with the ambassador at the time, who had a personal videotape that had some gunshots on it.
Jesus.
Okay, so where's the stuff that's not authentic?
That's from other places. It wasn't at the embassy, which was the main launch of this thing. So BBC had gunshots, and you could hear it in all. It's like a bad fact that gets repeated in Nexus over again. These gunshots are there in all the coverage, and they're not the real ones. Part of the reason I'm bringing this up is we had the real gunshots, and yet we paced them, we kind of layered them, we did a little set, to make, because they weren't very dramatic in the raw tape. So, real gunshots that we kind of enhanced.
Because the recording was a little bit far away from the gunshots?
Yeah,
Maybe
we added. I can't remember exactly, but we played with it. We played with the tape.
I think when we're going after that true sound, sometimes it's almost like sometimes we're doing it as a creative constraint because it feels like there are infinite possibilities. Mm. Let's go for the real thing. But also sometimes you line up tape with unrelated music or something like that, and it lines up so perfectly, and the music rises right at the moment you want it to rise, and you're like, oh, there is a God. These two pieces of tape were meant to be together. Mm-hmm. So I feel like we're all striving for that matchiness between the two elements, and when you don't hit it, it isn't going to work as well. I prefer the truthy tape. Have you ever heard those, have you ever been in the car listening to BBC on a road trip and it's 5 in the morning and you hear a mother wailing over her dead child and you're like, oh my God, the tape can be so real sometimes that it pulls you out of the world. But sometimes when it's not real, I feel like it's not as good. It doesn't line. I feel like sometimes it can line up and serve that purpose, but sometimes when it doesn't line up, it's just not as good.
I guess it depends how much you messed with it for me. I mean, it's you know, in the field you record tons of ambience, and then later you boost it or dip it so that you can put stuff over it or talk about it or even run, you know, conversations over it. It's, you know, it's a device to hold things together. You know, if these were actually the real gunshots and you just, you know, boost the volume and took off some hum or something like that, I don't think that it misrepresents the reality of the situation. And, you know, it may make it clearer. So it's hard to know. I don't, offhand, it does not outrage me as much as that fake paddling does.
I love that the adding a second of pause is your biggest ethical outrage.
That, you see, that adds intention. That's playing falsely with your guest, with your voice, the person that you've asked to give of his or her time to be in your thing. That's having him say something he didn't say. And the same thing is, I have a kind of, I no one manipulates tape more than I do. I mean, I'm a massive manipulator of tape. But one thing that I can't stand to do, even if I make that kind of date error, is to post-record a question or a remark that that the person I'm talking to hasn't heard. Even if it's completely innocuous, it's this terrifying slippery slope for me. Moving the information that's there, combining things, changing the order, all of those things I believe I can do without distorting the context and making it better. And after 13 and a half years of doing it, we've never had a complaint. So, you know, I think we do it well and really fairly. But the idea of saying something in an interview that I didn't actually say, even if it's to correct a date, I just can't do it. It makes me crazy. I'll take out the question. I'll put the information in the intro. I will turn myself into a pretzel not to go back into the studio and re-record a question.
So you're talking about your personal kind of rules. I mean, for me,
But that's what we're all talking
exactly.
about is the personal code.
And for me, the point of those clips, for me, is that the rules don't get you there. You know, it is, in the end, about like how you feel about what you're doing, what you feel matters. And
it's your rules get you there.
It's your rules get you there, exactly. And for me, like, that stuff is fun. Like, to find, you know, the Bells 1940, that just, like, gives me, I just love that.
I couldn't resist, like, not telling people that, even, like, in the credits. I mean, by the way, those are real fucking Bells from 1940. I would do that in the credits. I mean, I know you do a different style.
That's actually the best thing about having doing the podcast now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Welcome. Let's do a couple of golden rules, and I'm trying to figure out the timing. Johanna, just see about Q&A and
10 minutes.
Oh, really? Okay.
And we better do the Q&A.
Let's get to Q&A. We might run over just a little because we have this surprise
rules? Maybe
thing.
We should. No, okay.
Let's read just a couple more golden rules.
Deborah George.
And if you've got a question, come to the microphones.
You have to fall in and out of love with your subjects.
Always tell the truth. It's the easiest thing to remember. David Mamet.
I threw in a couple ringers.
What? Jonathan Kern, edit and mix your story honestly. Never pretend or give the impression through your production that you were somewhere you weren't or spoke to someone personally when the recording was made by someone else. If you add music, use it to punctuate your story, not manipulate listeners emotionally.
By the way, Jonathan Kern wrote the book on NPR ethics. I mean, literally, the book on NPR ethics. Mm-hmm. One more? You got one there? Okay.
This is one that you follow, Joe. Don't wait too long before thinking hard about structure.
That was it. Just in the deadline, you see, we got that right before the deadline.
We have a lot of questions.
I'm going to read one more. Because you see all those are little strips. This one, okay, I know. This will be really fast, but I just have to read this one. This one came from Ira Glass, and he wrote a whole page. Okay, that's good stuff here. Make stuff you yourself would be willing to listen to. That's the main do unto others golden rule as far as I'm concerned. Don't say anything shitty about anyone on the radio without giving them a chance to respond. Objectivity is impossible, but you can always achieve fairness. Start the music underneath your story in the middle of the rising action.
whatever is said immediately after you lose the music sounds extra important. Right, like you actually talk, not like the way you kid yourself that you talk, you fake sounding SOB. If you're performing badly on the mic, it's because you're not relaxed enough to fix it. Lower the pitch of your voice. If the piece isn't working, do another interview. To write a good ending, go back to the beginning, or tell the one anecdote, or kill the last piece of tape, or paraphrase it in script. Killing a mediocre story is victory. Killing a mediocre story is making room for an excellent story. Most stories want to be dull, and it's only through an act of will they become anything but. He said at the end, "I sound like some old Aesop fable motherfucker. Must stop now." Okay. There we go. Questions. And if you have a golden rule, or if you want to endorse any of those others, please do.
Hi, I'm Karen Brown from New England Public Radio, which is a very sort of traditional station. And I come from a very traditional journalistic background, and my boss, my news editor, would probably fire me on the spot for a lot of these. For like the 1979 thing. So I'm coming from that background. But I'm also thinking that like getting the tape that is really hard to get is part of what makes, from my background, a really good journalist, and what is the real get, and the thing that I'm most proud of is getting the pieces that that are really difficult. And if you don't get it, then you write around it or you have to be extra creative. And I was thinking, you know, is it fair to compare using sound effects as sort of performance-enhancing drugs? We have that that debate in our household a lot. And is it, you know, how much is it cheating when really you should be trying as a journalist to get the really hardest pieces of tape? And if you can't, then you can't.
I use it all. I feel like you should use everything. Maybe it is performance enhancing. Maybe it is manipulative. But yeah, fuck yeah. I like it.
Like, would people be less inclined to really try hard to get those really difficult pieces of tape if there's too many ways to get around it? I guess that's my question.
Yeah, I don't see all the producers I know. Their biggest problem is not that they don't work hard enough. You know what I mean? I think they all try really hard to get the best thing. I guess I do fall for that a little bit because I'm interspersed in my show a lot, so I like interrupt, and so I don't feel real need to be on when I'm interviewing, and because I put myself in later, and sometimes, I mean, most of the time I just throw out my side. I don't use it. I never think to use it at all because I know I'm going to do it later. If I didn't have a show structured the way my show is, I might be more on the ball and be more present in the moment and force things to happen and jump in a little bit more. But for the most part, I want them to tell the cleanest, clearest story they have, and then I can take it. And then so, like, in that sense, I don't know if I've become a better interviewer over time because the structure of my show allows me to not necessarily be the most... Like, I'm always amazed by people. Like, Sean Cole is one of my favorite producers, and he always has a moment in tape where he interacts. And he's so clever, and he's so on the ball, and I don't know how he does it. And, yeah, so.
I just want to say that I love performance-enhancing drugs. Like, I think radio needs more of these. Like, this is, like, the music in Serial, that is a performance-enhancing drug. It's incredible. It sets a tone. Like, it makes you feel things really deeply. Like, I am all for the drugs, and I feel like without them, we wouldn't be having this golden era of podcasting. It's because of the great shows that use it so well.
I just, you were smart to talk about where you come from. It's just a different context. You know, all of these things are applying to a different kind of presentation to an audience that understands those rules. So what happens there shouldn't apply to what happens
before. Yeah, and just to clarify, I really only mean in the news context. Yeah. I didn't mean in the more... So thank you.
Does, though, I mean, we all work in this sort of public radio umbrella. Does something that might harm credibility in one place, harm it in another place? Is that a concern?
It doesn't bother me. But, I mean, just because I think that it's unfair that everything has to be news in public radio.
Yeah, I mean, it's it may be true, but it's not relevant, really. I mean, we don't have to protect the legacy of you know, National Public Radio. It does a very good job of protecting its own credibility, and if some podcast somewhere does something else, we shouldn't worry about poisoning some single well. We've got a million different silos now.
Another question?
Thanks. I'm Daniel Gross. I'm an independent producer. So I was really surprised that there's this kind of mixing of what is good tape and what is ethically gathered and ethically presented tape.
Free range, we like.
So we had Don't Be Boring and we had Be Interesting. And those to me seem like editorial decisions. That's editorial craft in making something interesting. And that's something in my mind that needs to be balanced against ethical choices. And these are held in tension, and that's a good thing. You're sort of staying within the lines of the ethics in order to produce interesting tape. I'm really surprised to hear that interesting tape can be part of the ethics, can itself be an ethical kind of goal.
I'm so glad you said that, because with reference to Mike Pesca's rule, you know, be interesting. You know, I've never met anybody more interesting. He's also incredibly ethical, and I don't think that he means be interesting at all costs. Like, you know, be interesting if it means inventing a battle that happened, you know, somewhere, or just drag in anything you want in order to achieve to make something more interesting. I think that you begin with talk about something that's interesting, that it has to do with the selection of your subject matter, and then how you go about presenting that is a mixture of a whole lot of things that come into play, including interest and honesty and fairness and all those other things. I mean, we've both been in the unique position of having edited Mike Pesca, who writes all of his scripts in runic German, so it makes it very...
Five different fonts of runic German.
Five different fonts and no punctuations, yeah. But he is a singular mind. A brilliant guy and a real mensch on top of it. So when he says be interesting, that's a starting point. That's not the only point.
And part of that was he explained, like, if, let's say, 99% Invisible took a corporate sponsor to do a whole episode about their cool new device that they just made, like, that wouldn't be interesting. Like, if we do journalism for the wrong reasons, it takes the interestingness out of it. Or if you say that you met a 13-year-old girl at a factory in China and there weren't any 13-year-old girls, it makes it less interesting. So, and he also said that maybe NPR ombudsman should be going after people for being boring. Like, you never heard that happen.
Oh, I love that. Uh-huh. I'd take that job.
Okay, thank you.
Another question. Julia McAvoy, KQED Radio in San Francisco. So, Roman, sports sounds being added in. It sounds great, right? But here's my question. The NFL and concussions, and they've added in, like, you watch those NFL games and people hit each other, right? And it looks really bad. Even the visuals look really bad and dangerous. And you go, oh, my God, he's going to die. But then they've added in the, right? The big thud sounds and the people hitting each other's bodies and stuff like that. So what happens if NFL pressures Fox to reduce the thud sounds because it's giving the audience the impression that these guys could get concussions and the NFL could pay liability for that later in their lives?
Wow. Well, I guess this is where I would rely on the Pesca rule, is that actually makes it less interesting to not have the sounds. So, I mean, I think that Dennis Baxter, his production ethic is to make things, you know, feel as real as possible, and he has to do things to get back to the thing that they ruined. And whereas reducing the sound would violate his ethic there. And so that would be my sense of that. But that's interesting.
Sorry, we're just going to do two more questions because we have to wrap up, and also we have a little surprise coming at the end. So, but come on up afterwards. We can do questions individually up here. There's a bunch more golden rules in this bowl if you want to check them out. Maybe we'll publish them somehow, somewhere. Two more?
I tried to paper, rock, scissors to be absolutely
That's very ethical.
Ethical
of you.
Yeah, sorry. I use that in my marriage a lot.
My name is Amy, and I produce a podcast called Mother with Anne Noisani. And my question is, you know, now that there's all these different kind of podcasts and they're being created by people from industries outside of journalism, I'm actually a registered nurse. I have the Code of Nursing all written up and hung in my house, and I actually turn to that a lot for my ethical kind of guidelines, and I'm just kind of wondering if you guys have run into that in any other way. I'm sure social workers...
A lot of ethical guidelines share similar principles, which goes back to the golden rule we heard at the beginning, which is don't be an asshole. And I think that it makes perfect sense. You know, when you're dealing with a client as a nurse, there are codes of ethics. Now, obviously, they're not going to completely transfer, and I haven't heard your podcast, so I don't know the context. I don't know what my relationship with that material would be, as we described here. But, generally, you start with being a mensch when you're dealing with your subjects. You don't misrepresent them, and you don't misrepresent yourself to them. I think that is where some of the worst violations of just human ethics, civility, not even professional ones, begin.
I do think that is kind of a personal thing, though, and it depends on, like, the environment that you've grown up in, and lots of things can affect what your definition of asshole is. And there are some of us who, like, think of ourselves as asshole when, you know, I mean, my concern would not be, there are people out there, I'm going to say women, who, like, might think, I'm such an asshole for doing this. And there might be some man out there that's like, that's not even close to asshole. So, like, you said something about, like,
I think we could totally do a whole session just on...
right? I'm not trying to do that right now, people.
But, I'm just going to move us along a little bit.
Sorry. Come up after, because I'm really interested.
Okay, I think it's the last question, and then we're going to do one more thing.
So, you guys talked mostly about what it's okay to add. And I don't have issues with adding almost anything, but something that I regularly encounter as like an ethical dilemma is what it's okay to take out. I feel like there's a lot of stories that are so much more dramatic when you don't have all of these extra details that kind of like bog things down maybe, but also maybe tell another side of the truth of what happened, if that makes sense. Like, so it's not necessarily like... like, obviously, we don't care about things that are relevant, but things that are actually relevant, but kind of deflate the drama or the heroism of a character. How do you make those decisions? And where do ethics play into that?
I take out, 80% of my job is taking out stuff. So if they say some definitive statement and say, now keep in mind, generally I have to leave that in, you know, because they feel it is necessary to qualify their statement. If they feel it is necessary to, sometimes we'll have somebody who will make statements and then offer 6 qualifications to the same statement. I won't leave all of them in, but I will leave one in to say he does not say this without qualification. So the parts you have to leave in are the parts that ensure that what he's saying is what he meant. All the other stuff can go.
Yeah, I stick with, just trying to get what the person meant. That's the most important thing. I think I do, I could see reducing things to create more drama. Unfortunately, you just have to get to a point where you just, it's your gut. You know, like, did you reduce too much? Did you simplify it too much? To make it more dramatic and not distracting.
I love making the gist because we get to leave in aside sometimes. Like, we get to keep the personality in. And I feel like that's sometimes the most criminal thing you can take out, is that random aside where it's like, oh yeah, and that always makes me think of this, but it has nothing to do with the actual topic. So I think podcasting is going to open up a door where we can go off topic, where we can say things that we don't, that maybe someone has to Google after they hear it.
Oh, yeah. My whole show is built on digressions a lot of the time.
And sometimes the most memorable moment of anything. Yeah. So I think that's a criminal thing to take out sometimes.
I will say that, you know, the stakes in all this stuff is high. You know, credibility, is trust, all those things are pretty high. And as one indication, I'll tell you that you mentioned, you referred to the Mike Daisy thing in This American Life. I know that now they spend $25,000 to $30,000 a year on fact-checking. So, you know. To close, this we'll see how this works, but it was we learned that it was Bill Siemering's 80th birthday the other day. And if you don't know who Bill Siemering is, he wrote the mission statement and sort of the code of behavior for NPR back in 1970. And I hope I have Bill on the phone right here, and I asked him to read part of that mission statement. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, so I'm going to hold you up to the mic and see if people can hear.
Okay. All right. First, thank you for this invitation. It's wonderful to be with all of you, even by phone. I've been to some of the other Third Coast festivals, and they're wonderful experiences. So anyway, this is what I wrote in 1970. National Public Radio will serve the individual. It will promote personal growth. It will...
Hey there.
Rather than derision and hate. It will celebrate the human experience as infinitely varied, rather than vacuous and banal. It will encourage a sense of active, constructive participation, rather than apathetic helplessness. The total service to be trustworthy, enhance intellectual development, expand knowledge, deepen all aesthetic enjoyment, increase the pleasure of living in a pluralistic society, and result in a service to listeners which makes them more responsive in...
Oh. Wow. Hold on one second. Just talk amongst yourselves.
I would cut out those pauses.
We got cut off. I'm going to have you finish, okay? Okay, ready.
As this is what the came off is considered part of that description is, it would not substitute superficial blandness for genuine diversity of regions, values, and cultural and ethnic minorities, which comprise American society. It would speak with many voices and many dialects. The editorial attitude would be that of inquiry, curiosity, concern for the quality of life, critical, problem-solving, and life-loving. And the last sentence, National Public Radio will not regard its audience as a market with disposable income. It is curious, complex individuals who are looking for some understanding, meaning, and joy in the human experience. So that's that was in 1970.
Bill, just before we go, I think just we're going to have everyone just wish you happy birthday. Okay, ready? One, two, three.
Happy birthday, Bill!
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for doing that.
Sure.
Okay.
Best wishes for the rest of the conference. Okay.
Bye.
Thanks so much. Bye now.
He is really one of the greatest human beings.
He really is. Ever. Oh, my God.
Thank you, and have a great rest of the conference.